We turn in the Word of God this morning to Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2. We're going to read verses 1 through verse 18 of this chapter to the glory of God this morning. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had died, debated, he remembered Vashti, and what she had done, and what she had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the woman. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shemaiah, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jehoiachin, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel in the custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the woman. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the woman, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shezgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go in to the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the woman, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Amen. May God bless the reading of his word. If only I had not said that. If only I had not done that. If only I had my time again. If only I could have another opportunity. If only. How much is your life clouded by the if only? Maybe you're too young. Maybe you haven't reached a stage yet in life where you have made a serious mistake. Without desiring that you should do, nonetheless, the reality is it is highly unlikely that any of us, whatever age we are, will make passage through this life without making one or two, if not three or four, major choices in our lives that will result us subsequently thinking to ourselves, if only. If only I had my time again. I know that my life has been affected by two, if not three, serious and major if onlys. The thing about if only in your life and mine is this. They are so hard to take because we know that we took the decision that led to choices being made, which resulted in experiences being lived out, which then led in time to if only. The if onlys of our lives, we can't point to other people and say, if he had done it differently or if she had done it differently, then I wouldn't be in this situation today. The real heartbreaking if onlys of our lives are heartbreaking because it is we who have taken the decision. When others take decisions that affect our lives in serious ways, it doesn't hit us as hard. For whatever reason, it doesn't reside in our memories as long. For whatever reason, it doesn't have the same emotional impact on us. Maybe it's because deep down, as human beings, we think we are perfect. And although we see other people making mistakes in their lives, well, we are certainly never going to make a mistake in our life. I am not going to do that. I am not going to do that. I'm not going to get engaged in that. You would never see me getting caught up in that situation. I would never get myself into that context that would allow myself to engage in that activity or to say that thing that would result in this harm being done to my life and to other people's lives and the resulting if only arise. I would never do that. Other people do things to me, but that's because other people are not perfect, whereas I am perfect. I always get it right. That's the reason why the if only is so hard on us. Because we see ourselves as being perfect, and when we get it wrong, then it really hits us hard. Really hits us hard. How can we stop the big if only decisions in our lives going wrong. I think the opening two chapters of Esther are very useful in this regard. On the one hand, we see a bad decision made, which leads to a really sad, if only experience. A bad decision made, which leads to a really sad, if only experience. And the other, we see a good decision made that leads to an opportunity of a lifetime. A good decision made which leads to an opportunity of a lifetime. Let's look first at a bad decision made which leads to a really sad, if only, experience. I'm not going to begin with the really sad experience. I'm going to begin, rather, with the sad experience and work back from there. Esther chapter 2, verse 1. What do we read? After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what had been done and what had been decreed against her. Who is Vashti? Well, Vashti is now his former wife, the woman who had sat on the throne beside him as his queen, the woman who had regularly occupied his bed. He remembers her because she is no longer with him, not because she has died, but because he has taken a decision which resulted in her being banished from his presence. He decided to dispose her of her royal legal position. The one gets a sense from what the Bible tells us here in chapter 2, verse 1, that this is a moment in the life of King Ahasuerus which would lead to an if only thought. If only I hadn't done that. If only I hadn't taken that decision. You can picture him sitting wherever he is, whether he's in the royal palace in Susa or sitting on the throne or sitting on the edge of his bed. He is remembering with fond memories his wife Vashti. And he's thinking to himself, if only I had not taken that decision, I would not be in this situation now. And you may think, well, he's the king. He's an all-powerful monarch. Surely he has the power to undo the decision which he did. If he had the power to decree that Vashti would no longer be permitted into his presence, then as an all-powerful, absolute monarch, he surely has the power to rescind that decision and to bring her back in. If anybody can restore her to her position of royal authority, it is King Ahasuerus. But you see, this is not the Babylonian Empire. It's not even the Scottish kingdom of the 17th century. The Babylonians and the Scottish kings of the 17th century had an absolute monarchy in which whatever they said went. And there was no one or nothing who could contradict them. That's why the issue that gave rise to the signing of the National Covenants and the Solemn League and Covenant, which resulted in many of the deaths of our forefathers, was such a pertinent point, because they were standing against the absolute authority of the kings over all princes, all authorities, all churches, all realms in this land of Scotland. Well, that wasn't the law of the Medes and the Persians, you see. The situation here had changed. when the Persians and the Medes had taken over the empire from the Babylonians, they had introduced a law whereby no longer could the king just give an edict and then change it. The law now became the supreme rule. And if a king entered into an agreement with his leaders and that became law, then that remained law. That's why the law of the Medes and the Persians is such a famous statement. The law could not be changed by anyone. Not even the king himself could change the law. You'll remember how Daniel, in the situation in which he was involved, how when they tried to entrap him, they used the means of the law. Let me read to you from Daniel chapter 6, verses 6 to 8. These are the men who are seeking to entrap Daniel because of his worship of God. They come and they say to the king, O king, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdoms and the governors and the princes or the rulers and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask any petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into a den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree, sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not. And we all know what happened, Daniel, and the subsequent events. So here was a king who didn't have the liberality to make a choice and then change his mind. He was constrained. That's why it says at the end of verse 1, and what had been decreed against her. It wasn't simply the decision that had been taken against Vashti. It was the fact that this had now passed into law which could not be rescinded. Returning then to King Ahasuerus and the decision he made. How did this happen? What led up to this bad decision being made, which resulted in this if-only experience for King Ahasuerus? When he woke up that morning and found himself with his head in his hands, thinking to himself, how on earth did I get myself into this position? What were the events that he would have unfurled in his mind? How did it happen? Well, it's incredibly simple how it happened. In fact, it's so simple how it happened, it's almost unbelievable that it did happen. That here was the wife of the king, the queen, disposed on the basis of something so absolutely insignificant as her unwillingness to come into his presence on one occasion. Think about that. Think about how unreal that is. That here is a man who is now without his wife. Here is a nation no longer with a queen, simply because she had refused on one occasion, when asked to come into his presence. It's almost unbelievable. And yet it happened. How did it happen? It happened because his thinking had become unclear. He wasn't thinking clearly. And because he wasn't thinking clearly, he got himself into this situation. He took a decision when his thinking was impaired by the context. Cast your mind back to chapter 1. The context that gave rise to these events was the feast that he held. He is buoyed by the activity. He's excited by the event. He's on a high. It's never good to make a decision when you're on a high. It's never good to make a decision when you're excited. It's never good to make a decision when everything in the world seems wonderful. His thinking is impaired by the context in which he is in. Here he is in this situation, and instead of making cold, rational decisions, he is going on the influence of the situation and the emotion of the situation. Secondly, we read in chapter verse 10 of verse 1 that his thinking is impaired because of the influence of alcohol. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. And we all know what effect alcohol can have on the mind. Well, it not only blurs the vision and makes walking difficult, but people become incoherent. I'm not saying he was drunk, but he was merry. He wasn't thinking clearly because, again, this merely added to the joy-filled sense of the context in which he was living. Everything was going well. Everything was buoyant. Everybody was telling him how good he is as a king. Everybody is there watching it and seeing him in all his royal splendor and his regalia. His chest is pumped out. He is in the greatest power ego trip of his kingship. Kingship. And he makes this decision. His thinking was impaired because of anger. When Vashti refuses to come, we read in verse 12 of chapter 1 that the king became enraged. And his anger burned within him. He was flamingly angry. The fire was breathing out of his nostrils. And each of us know that when we're angry, it's not a good time to make a decision. Because we say things that we later will regret. Because we go over the top. We don't actually deal with the real issue. We deal with the issue plus all the add-ons of what has been going on in our life that day or that week or that month. And suddenly, that which is a reasonable thing to say becomes highly unreasonable by venture of our anger. Becomes unreasonable, let alone unacceptable. Never good to make a decision when you're angry. And his thinking was impaired because he chose to take the advice and the counsel of those around him when the choice he had to make was very simple. A very simple choice. He was dealing with his wife here. He wasn't dealing with a great matter of state. He wasn't dealing with the great issue of that was going to affect the nation. It stretched the whole way from Pakistan right up into Uzbekistan and into Turkey and into Greece and into Egypt. It wasn't a matter of state that was going to influence all the peoples of the nation. It did result in that, but it should never have. He should quietly have gone and said to his wife and sat down and asked her, "Why are you not coming? You have an obligation. You have a responsibility. You are my queen." He should have gone personally to her and talked to her. He didn't do that. He took the advice of the men in the court around him. And of course, they seeing the king's embarrassment, they seeing his embarrassment and feeling his embarrassment, in order to relieve their king of any sense of doing wrong, they then turn it into a matter of national importance. There he is, sitting on the edge of the bed, or sitting on the throne, or sitting at a table in the palace, wherever he is, sitting, remembering, when his anger has abated, remembering Vashti. And thinking, if only I had not allowed the party atmosphere to get to me. If only I hadn't become so merry on the alcohol. If only I hadn't gone into a rage when she didn't come. If only I had not taken the advice of those who wanted to please me. Then Vashti would still be here. Such a simple, tiny thing. A tiny, tiny, tiny thing. His wife not coming into his presence. And suddenly, their marriage is over. The joy he had in that marriage is over. And the whole palace entourage is turned upside down. A bad decision made, leading to a sad, if only, experience. We make bad decisions when our thinking isn't clear. We make bad decisions when we make them in the context in which we shouldn't make them. Decisions not made in the cold light of day are not good decisions. Decisions made when our heart is merry, not necessarily with alcohol, but with a situation, when we feel as if everything is going well, we take a decision in haste, which he took. When we're angry or influenced by other people, how easy it is to take a decision based on the influences around us. Influences of people who want to please us. Not want to do what's right by God, but want to please us, or want us to please them. It's amazing how often we take decisions in our lives not based on the clarity that is revealed in the Word of God, but we take our decisions based on other issues around us or what other people think. If we were actually to stop and actually think about some of the decisions we make and think, how on earth could I have got myself into that situation and make that choice? How, whenever God says, do this, I have turned around and blatantly not done what God has said? Or when God says, don't do this, I have blatantly turned around and said, done what God has told me not to do. And we waken up and think, how on earth did I ever get myself into that situation where I do what God doesn't want me to do, or I don't do what God does want me to do? Surely if I am a believer in Jesus Christ, surely if I'm saying I'm walking in the ways of righteousness, surely if I'm saying that I'm going to spend eternity with God and I trust God for all my eternal existence, how did I ever take that decision? How did I ever take that decision? Well, I'll tell you how we take those decisions. We take those decisions based on the fact that we don't think clearly. Here is a situation where the thinking is not right. And why is the thinking not right? Why is it not clear? Because we're taking the influence of other people. The influence of other people. And it doesn't come with a great cloud over us. It doesn't come with a great gusto. It certainly doesn't overwhelm us. It's a drip, drip effect. It's a drip, drip effect. A drip, drip effect. It's not that suddenly we are stirred up by people who want to come in and take over our lives. That's not what happens. It's we make this choice, we make this choice, we make this choice, we make this choice, and suddenly we're in a position where what we think, a position we would never made that choice before, suddenly we find ourselves doing it. Something that we would never have done before, we find ourselves doing it. Why? Why do we find ourselves doing it? Because we listen to those whom we should not listen to. Whether it be the context, whether it be anger that seethes within us, or whether it be the influence of others. A bad decision made leads to if only experiences. On the other hand, in Esther chapter 2, we read about a good decision made, which leads to an opportunity of a lifetime. A good decision made. Here we have two new people introduced. One is Mordecai and the other is Esther. Mordecai, we are told, is a Jew. He's a son of Jair, the son of Shammai, the son of Kish. He's a son of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, when you go on and read that he was carried away from Jerusalem about among the captives, in terms of their chronology, it doesn't actually fit. It doesn't actually fit that Mordecai was carried away himself. It must be that his family line was carried away, and he is in Susa because his royal family line because Kish was the father of King Saul. So Mordecai is of the royal line. So when Jehoiachin was carried off with the royals and the nobles of Judah, then the family line of Mordecai must have been carried with him. And he's carried off and he has found himself in Susa. And this is a number of years before. We read that he's bringing up his cousin, Hadassah. That's her name that's been given to her. It's a Hebrew name. The name that she's given, just as Mordecai is given a Persian name, because Mordecai is a take on the god of the Persians, Marduk. So Hadassah is given the name, which means myrtle, is given the name Esther. He's bringing up her cousin, his cousin, the daughter of his uncle. Two new people who suddenly come on the scene. She, we are told in verse 7, is a beautiful looking young woman. She has a beautiful figure and she is lovely to look at. And Mordecai has taken her into his home to be his own daughter in order to care for her as his daughter. There then comes an edict. This edict has arisen out of the young men, we read in verse 3 and or 2 and 3 of the palace, who have looked at the king and have seen his despondency and have come up with this suggestion that all the beautiful young virgins in the region be brought to the king, and that they then are brought into the care of the king's eunuch, Haggai, and that as a result, the king will pick one of these young women as a replacement for his wife, or former wife, Vashti. Now we read that in the course of this edict being worked out in practice, that Esther is taken from her cousin Mordecai, and she is brought in, verse 8, into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai. There's no sense or inference here that Mordecai handed her over. It's not that Mordecai thought to himself, well, this is some way in which I can establish a link with the royal palace. It's not that he in a subtle way was handing over his cousin to be looked after and cared for so that he would no longer have that responsibility. It's very clear that when the edict comes, verse 8, that she is taken as one of the young women living in the palace area or the capital city of Susa. She is taken from her home and she is brought in as one who is going to be brought before the king. Now here is where we see the basis of a good decision made. Because we read that Esther does well in the house of Haggai. And the reason why Esther does well is not only because of her beauty, but it's because she doesn't give any indication of who she is. She doesn't single herself out as a Jew. She listens to the instruction being given to her by her cousin Mordecai. And she not only hears what he has to say, but she does what he has to say. He had told her, verse 10, not to make known to the others her people or her kindred. And here Esther demonstrates what it is to make a good decision. What's involved in making a good decision? What's involved in making a good decision is listening. Listening. That's the precursor to a good decision. A good decision is taken in the clear light of day when the person listens to the advice that is being given to them. Esther listened to the advice of Mordecai. If Esther had said to her cousin Mordecai, "You have no legal responsibility over me. I'm your cousin. I'm grateful to you for the care that you provided for me since my mother and father died. But now I am an age when I can make my own choices. I can make my own way in the world. I can do what I want to do. I am not bound to listen to you." She could have legitimately said that. But she chooses not to. And it's specifically because of her choosing to listen to the wisdom of her cousin Mordecai that she finds herself in a position of favor with Haggai. That's the clear relationship. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. He quickly provided her with cosmetics and food and 7 chosen young women from the king's palace. And he advanced her unto the best of the harem. And the reason is given in verse 10 that Esther did not make herself known. She did not make herself known because Mordecai had commanded her not to make herself known. And surely today, many of us in this building who have if onlys ringing around in our minds and ringing around in our hearts, if only we hadn't been so proud and so arrogant and we had listened when someone came to us and said to us, "Is this the right thing to do? Do you think you're being wise here? Do you think this will result in your good and God's glory?" If we hadn't been so proud and so arrogant and say to them, "No, I'll make my own choices in life. You have no responsibility to me. You have no jurisdiction over my life. It's my life." Now, you don't have to say that loudly. You can say it quietly. Say it quietly. You can sit and you can give the impression that you're hearing, but your thoughts are entirely different. You're thinking to yourself, "Well, that's all right. I hear what you're saying, but I'm not listening. Not listening." Clear thinking led to this woman listening. First to Mordecai. And then we see she then proceeds to listen to Haggai. We read that when the time comes for her to go into the presence of the king, verse 15, that she takes the advice of Haggai. Haggai says to her, "This is what you should do." Esther doesn't turn around and say to him, "I know what I'm going to do when I go into the king's palace. I know what I will do." She doesn't stand there and present that she is a woman that knows everything that there is to know. No, again, she is quiet of heart. She is quiet of heart. She is prepared to listen and take the counsel of a man who knows. And he advises her. It says, when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace, we see that the king loved her and she won grace and favor in his sight. Why did the king find grace and favor in Esther? Was it solely because of her beauty? It was solely because she looked well? No, he found grace and beauty in Esther because we all know that beauty is only skin deep. It's only skin deep. That real, genuine beauty in a woman is her character. Real beauty is a character. A woman's character is what makes her beautiful. Some of the most physically beautiful women in the world have a character that is unbelievably unacceptable in terms of just humanity. And we see that evidence in the tantrums that they throw. And some of the most unbeautiful women in the world are most beautiful because of their character. Because of their character. And Esther's character here has been shaped not only by her parents, not only by the influence of Mordecai, but she's prepared to take the advice even of Haggai, recognizing that this man does know. He does know because he is the king's head eunuch in regard to this matter. And again, How often in life do we experience the if only because we are not prepared to take the advice or the counsel of others? We know best. We will do what we think is best. We will achieve what we want to achieve, regardless of whatever. And then we reach a point where we realize, I will not achieve what I want to achieve, regardless of whatever. I don't have the wisdom. I don't have the power. I don't have the strength. I don't have the knowledge. We don't achieve what we think we will achieve. We are knocked back on our heels. And then we live the regret, if only. If only, if only, if only. If only I had listened. If only I had not been carried away, intoxicated with the situation, the context. If only I had not been carried away with the influence of others who shouldn't have been influencing me at all in this situation. If only my thinking had not been impaired by anger or resentment towards someone else. If only I had listened. If only I had been prepared to, as it were, humble myself sufficiently and to hear what that person really had to say, rather than turn around and say, well, that's your view. That's your view. Here is a young woman who demonstrates a capacity to think clearly, taking the counsel of those who have responsibility for her, those whom she is willingly prepared to put herself under the responsibility of. And it doesn't just apply to a young woman, by the way. It doesn't just apply to young men. It applies to all of us. All of us. And because she had taken a good decision based on taking the advice of those who knew, we find her with the crown on her head. Now that's unbelievable. That Esther, orphaned as a child or as a young woman, it's unbelievable that Esther would ever have dreamed of being in a position where she would have been crowned queen. She wasn't a Mede or a Persian. There was no basis upon which she would ever have got her foot in the palace door. Esther would never even have dreamed of becoming queen. It wouldn't have been something that she could have even have seen herself becoming, because the context would not have lent itself to her becoming queen. She was exempt from that situation. She was exempt from that situation by her nationality. And yet, here she is in God's providence, having listened, having taken advice from her cousin, having listened, having taken advice from Haggai. Here she is, sitting on the throne, a feast being thrown for her because she is now queen. A good decision leading to an opportunity of a lifetime. A good decision which will ultimately, as we shall see in a few weeks, lead to her being in a position to save thousands of her nationality. Life is not difficult to lead. Life is easy. God has made it easy. We make it difficult when we make bad decisions, taking advice from the wrong people at the wrong time of day, in the wrong situation. That leads to if onlys. When we take decisions in the cool light of day from people who know the ways of God and walk in the ways of God, then it leads to a life of opportunity and a life of real joy. It's not difficult. We make it difficult. We are responsible for our own lives. No one else is. We are responsible for our own lives. There are certainly things happen in life that we have no control over. Illness, loss of a job, financial difficulty. Those are things that hit us that we have no control over at all. But we do have control over the choices that we make. And those choices neither end in "if only" or in a crown. The ball's in your court and in mine.